I'd like to welcome you to the Austrian Circle. This is the program where we talk about the economics of freedom here on WHUS Stores 91.7 FM. So thank you so much for tuning into my show this morning. We are going to be talking about the presidency on the show today. The campaign for 2016 is well underway. We have our forerunners of Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, and Donald Trump. And today we're going to be talking about them in particular, but also about reassessing the presidency. About 100 years ago or so, starting with Woodrow Wilson, the presidency became a sort of personality game where people with big personalities felt that they were the most capable to lead the nation. And so they came in with their big ideas and they have to get government to do all these really big things around the world. Well, that hasn't quite turned out the way that we would have liked it to turn out. There's still a lot of turmoil. There's still a lot of poverty. There's still a lot of problems, even though government has grown to a gargantuan size compared to what it was in the 1800s. In the 1800s, most people were not really affected by the presidential elections and by the government as a organization itself. The government had almost no involvement in the economic affairs of the early Americans, and this is a stark contrast to what is going on today in the world around us. So I'd like to read to you today from The Austrian. This is a publication of the Mises Institute. It is the May and June issue of 2016, and it's about presidential campaigns and economic myths. I'm going to start with reading the introduction by Jeff Diest. Politics and economics don't mix, or at least they shouldn't. Last time I checked, none of the presidential candidates were talking about the laws of physics or thermodynamics. They don't claim to run for office as scientists or technicians, but they certainly take liberties with the science of economics. As William Anderson explains in our cover article, presidential election years bring out the worst in economic myth peddling. But the biggest issue of all, the Federal Reserve, goes strangely unremarked. Presidential elections in the United States spawn really bad economic policies, and 2016 is a vintage year. Bernie Sanders is resurrecting socialism, and others seek to outdo him. However, before leaping into the abyss of campaign rhetoric, I first note that none of the current candidates are doing what Ron Paul did during his presidential primary campaign 4 years ago, that is, exposing the misdoings of the Federal Reserve system. Candidates promise everything from living wages to free health care and college. Proposals about how to run whole segments of the economy are made with a straight face. The most tired and hackneyed ideas about income equality, corporate greed, unemployment, and paying one's fair share are all trotted out. And millions of voters apparently believe it all, falling for the same promises of free stuff and prosperity from Washington. How do political candidates get away with this nonsense year after year and election after election? William Anderson is going to answer that question in his article called Peddling Economic Myths. Ron Paul is the only presidential candidate in recent history, to my knowledge, that exposed the Federal Reserve system for what it is. Without Ron Paul, candidates approve of the Fed's eternal bubble machine that sends false investment signals and drives crony capitalism malinvestments that either must be liquidated in the future or will continue to gobble resources from profitable sectors. Indeed, one wonders if any of the candidates realize the damage the Federal Reserve is doing. Bernie Sanders. On that happy note, we turn to Sanders. In an earlier article on his economic proposals, I wrote, Sanders emulates Benito Mussolini, someone Sanders is supposed to hate. like Mussolini, who, like his ally Adolf Hitler, hated free markets and fancied himself a socialist. Sanders does not seek actual government seizure of property, but rather seeks de facto government ownership through taxation and regulation. Sanders will definitely increase taxes. For example, he says he will tax Wall Street speculation to raise funds to pay free tuition at public institutions. Likewise, he wants to raise the top marginal rates above 50% and substantially increase taxes on capital gains and dividends. Sanders believes that wealthy people absorbing huge tax increases won't change their behavior afterward, which demonstrates Sanders' zero understanding of finance or the production of goods. In fact, he claims the American middle class is created by wealth transfers. Sanders declares, quote, "If you have seen a massive transfer of wealth from the middle class to the top 0.1%, you know what? We've got to transfer that back if we're going to have a vibrant middle class. And you do that in a lot of ways. Certainly, one way is tax policy." In one sense, Sanders is correct. There is a wealth transfer from the middle class to the wealthy, but it occurs because of the policies Sanders supports. If Sanders has any criticism of the Fed, it is his belief that interest rates should go even lower. He supports vast subsidies given to green energy producers that involve diversion of resources from higher valued to lower valued uses. He supports policies that subsidize home ownership, and he supports the huge central bank purchases of sovereign debt that have choked the productive economic activity of America. I also mentioned Sanders' outright hostility toward free exchange, be it international trade or a kid's lemonade stand. Socialists can't comprehend how free exchange is mutually beneficial, while Sanders believes free markets are predatory and government coercion is freedom. It is true he is speaking out on government trade deals, which are not free trade in any sense of the word, but neither has Sanders expressed any support for lowering of trade barriers. Economist Gerald Friedman of the University of Massachusetts Amherst claims that incomes will soar under Sanders' policies and that poverty will be cut in half. How? Friedman says it would be done by pouring $14.5 trillion into the economy via subsidies, public works, healthcare savings, and new taxes. In other words, Sanders would make opportunity cost disappear. Hillary Clinton. Since Clinton is favored to win the November presidential election, her proposed economic policies matter more than do Sanders's, although it is more fun to write about Sanders. Thanks to the Sanders challenge, her stump speeches are full of anti-Wall Street rhetoric, which is ironic since she has made millions of dollars from speaking fees paid by Wall Street firms, and the very crony capitalism she denounces has made Hillary and her husband very wealthy. One doubts seriously that hedge fund managers pay less tax than an average nurse or truck driver, as she claimed in an Iowa speech. But unlike Sanders, a true believer in socialism and his left-wing rhetoric, Clinton simply is trying to get elected. This does not mean, however, that Hillary supports free markets. It's just that she uses populist left rhetoric to win elections. If there is an economic model for Clinton to follow, it would be Barack Obama's current one, for Hillary is a candidate of the status quo. For all of the change rhetoric from Obama, his actual economic regime was more of the same, but more was on steroids. The Fed continued and greatly expanded its late Bush-era policy of purchasing long-term treasuries and mortgage securities, and a Hillary presidency would likely see QE to the nth power. When Clinton talks free trade, she speaks not of free exchange, but political trade deals, in which politically favored firms receive privileges and benefits in making deals with foreign governments. Instead of simply allowing goods to cross borders unimpeded, these treaties like NAFTA and the newest proposed trade agreement with China are Rube Goldberg agreements at their finest. What, quote, new policies could we expect from a Hillary presidency? According to her website, we should see the following. A $12 minimum wage, new investment in infrastructure, which is a euphemism for massive public works, an old socialist saw, raise business and individual income taxes. Like Obama, she claims she will create a huge clean energy economy with good-paying jobs, even though the current clean energy initiatives are destroying good-paying jobs by forcing the relatively healthy sectors of the economy to subsidize the losers, such as wind power and ethanol. Destruction lurks in every turn with her environmental policies, with more government goals imposed upon Americans with no sense of consequences. And why not? Clinton, at worst, will be inconvenienced by such policies. Ordinary Americans will be driven into poverty. In short, Hillary promises to raise taxes, increase regulatory burdens on business, force up energy prices through environmental regulation, and force up the nation's minimum wage by more than 50%. At the same time, she will encourage the Fed to continue on its own path of economic destruction by forcing down interest rates and underwriting the crony capitalist regime. Donald Trump. Then there is the Donald. Unlike Sanders and Clinton, Trump has tapped into people who have seen their own communities devastated by deindustrialization and who have been left behind in the high-tech boom. Trump supporters don't work for Apple and Google. Regarding taxes, Trump does seem to have the best plan of the three remaining candidates. Carrying out such tax reforms requires the consent of Congress, which tends to worship high tax rates. However, lowering both personal income tax rates and business taxes would be a good start toward removing some of the worst excesses of the Obama administration years. Trump's economic Waterloo, however, is trade. Trump has always prided himself on negotiating and deal-making, yet unencumbered trade does not need the U.S. government cutting deals with other nations. It needs the government to get out of the way. While Trump claims he only wants fair trade, nonetheless he is flirting with creating some worldwide trade disasters. And the last time this happened during the early 1930s, the results were catastrophic. Part of the problem is that Trump thinks like a mercantilist, believing that a nation's survival depends upon the value of exports being greater than imports. For example, he claims that the value of China's currency, the yuan, is too low relative to the US dollar, so he would declare China to be a currency manipulator. As any Austrian economist will tell you, there is no such thing as an optimal exchange rate. Each rate has advantages and disadvantages, depending upon whose interest rates are at stake. Furthermore, given that the Fed truly and actually is a currency manipulator, it seems hypocritical to accuse other nations of doing what the U.S. government already is doing. Furthermore, there is something unseemly about running a political campaign against yet another Asian country. In the 1980s and 90s, American politicians blamed Japan and even South Korea for any economic ill this country had. For more than a decade, the bogeyman has been China. For all of the complaints about slave labor in other countries, the main reason that much of the manufacturing of consumer goods and some capital goods has moved abroad is because the political climate in the USA is extremely hostile to domestic investment. That politicians like Sanders are extremely popular is unnerving to potential investors who are not interested in taking huge risks and then having the government confiscate the proceeds. To his credit, Trump is the only person left in the race that actually understands this last point. One doubts that Sanders has a clue about capital formation, and Clinton is too craven to care. Have fun in the voting booth. That article was by William L. Anderson, and you can find it online at Mises.org. I'm reading from The Austrian, which is a publication of the Mises Institute. The next article I would like to read highlights Hillary Clinton in particular and talks about her book, which she called Hard Choices, and which David Gordon has claimed are very easy choices. Few books have as misleading a title as Hard Choices. For Hillary Clinton, as this tedious memoir of her years as Secretary of State makes evident, there are no hard choices. The solutions to all political and economic problems are easy. We must always rely on the directing hand of government, guided by the superior wisdom of our moral and intellectual betters, Hillary Clinton foremost among them. In her main discussion of economic policy, she says something that will surprise those familiar with her record. She contrasts China with America, quote, "China had become the leading exponent of an economic model called state capitalism, in which state-owned or state-supported companies used public money to dominate markets and advance strategic interests. These principles ran directly counter to the values and principles we had worked to embed in the global economy. We believed an open, free, transparent, and fair system with clear rules of the road would benefit everyone." Have we been unjust to Mrs. Clinton? Is she in fact a supporter of the free market? No, she is not, despite her criticism of China's resort to state control. The giveaway is her phrase, "a fair system with clear rules of the road." Among the things she means by this is that foreign countries must enact similar labor legislation to that prevalent in America. On no account must foreign countries try to undercut America by offering employers the chance to hire cheaper labor. Quote, "lowering barriers to access for American companies was a big part of our efforts. So was raising standards in foreign markets on key issues like labor rights and environmental protection. Companies in the United States already met these standards, but those of many other countries didn't. We needed to level the playing field and improve a lot of lives around the world along the way. For too long, we'd seen companies closing factories and leaving the United States where they didn't have to pay workers a living wage or abide by U.S. rules on pollution. Using diplomacy and trade negotiations to raise standards abroad could help change that calculus." Thus, far from supporting the free market, she wants the government to pressure other nations to adopt restrictive policies. In doing so, she illustrates a key point that Ludwig von Mises often emphasized. Government intervention in the free market fails to achieve its ostensible purpose and often leads to further intervention to correct the untoward results of the initial interference. Here, costly environmental and labor legislation supposedly aimed at helping American workers puts many of them out of work by making firms unable to compete with foreign companies. To remedy this, she wishes to burden foreign firms as well. This restores a, quote, "level playing field." It never occurs to her that the policies she favors will destroy the jobs of impoverished foreign workers. To grasp this would require of her a few minutes of thought, and she just doesn't have the time. Instead, she conjures up a fantasy world not governed by economic law. Quote, "in many countries around the world, unions are still suppressed. This is bad for them, and it's bad for American workers, too, because it creates unfair competition that drives down wages for everyone. Contrary to what some governments and employers might think, research shows that respecting workers' rights leads to positive economic outcomes, including higher levels of foreign direct investment." In sum, increased labor costs and then employment and investment will rise. Such is Clintonian economics. Can we at least give her credit for favoring free trade? No, we cannot. True enough, she opposes foreign restrictions of American investments and sales abroad, but this for her is subsumed under a broader strategy of governmental guidance of American business. She does not say, quote, let's end tariffs and other restrictions so firms can trade as they wish. Instead, she endeavors to guide American business in directions that she favors. Quote, I made export promotion a personal mission. During my travels, I often made a pitch for an American business or product, like GE in Algeria. We got creative with initiatives like Direct Line, which allowed our ambassadors to host phone calls or video chats with American businesses eager to break into foreign markets. It is ironic that she criticizes China for its state capitalism when she fails completely to grasp the difference between genuine free enterprise and government-business partnership. When we turn to climate change, the same pattern of thought recurs. In exact opposition to her book's title, there are no hard choices, and as always, salvation lies in the state. She says, quote, the problems of global warming are evident despite the deniers. There was a mountain of overwhelming scientific data about the damaging effects of carbon dioxide, methane, and other greenhouse gases. A serious, comprehensive response to climate change remains stymied by entrenched political opposition at home. The old false choice between promoting the economy and protecting the environment surfaces again. Prominent scientists like Richard Lindzen and Fred Singer would dissent from her assessment of the scientific evidence about global warming. But let us put the controversy to one side and consider the matter using the understanding that she favors of the scientific data. Measures to reduce greenhouse gases impose severe costs on business. Must not these costs be weighed against the supposed benefits of the measures she favors? She makes no attempt to do so. Rather, for her, there is no need at all for choice between economic growth and regulating the environment. At one point, though, reality is so insistent that she cannot ignore it. If the environmental regulations for America that she wants were imposed, the goal she seeks could not be achieved. Quote, even if the United States somehow reduced our emissions all the way to zero tomorrow, total global levels would still be nowhere near what they need to be if China, India, and others failed to contain their own emission. Once more, the failure of intervention begets proposal for more intervention. Environmental regulation must be extended worldwide. Quote, the United States was pushing for what we considered a realistic, achievable outcome, a diplomatic agreement agreed to by leaders, which would commit every major nation, developed and developing alike, to take substantive steps to curb carbon emissions and report transparently on their progress. Clinton's plan to control the world extends far beyond environmental regulation. She has an ideological human rights agenda that she demands other nations accept. To the objection that importuning and threatening other nations arouses resentment and thus threatens American security, she has an answer that should by now be familiar. Quote, throughout the history of American foreign policy, there has been a running debate between so-called realists and idealists. The former, it is argued, place national security ahead of human rights, while the latter do the opposite. These are categories I find overly simplistic. Over the long term, repression undermines stability and creates new threats, while democracy and respect for human rights creates strong and stable societies. Once more, there is no need for human choice. Interference with other nations does not threaten our security, but promotes it. Have we not heard this before? Quote, the world must be made safe for democracy. In pursuit of this ambitious goal, she pressures other nations that enact measures she deems inappropriate. If the, quote, regime of Vladimir Putin in Russia has enacted a series of anti-gay laws prohibiting the adoption of Russian children by gay couples, then why is it the business of the United States to endeavor to change this? Clinton's attempt to impose on other nations her ideological views are, in Edmund Burke's phrase, an armed doctrine. Clinton has a high opinion of the effects of her inflated rhetoric about rights. Quote, the ripples created by the speech about LGBT rights were bounced around the globe and back, and my phone was soon crowded with messages. A huge number of people had watched the speech online. Her image of herself as one of the world's moral teachers, correcting the less enlightened, brings to mind a familiar passage of the Bible. Quote, the Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself, God, I thank thee that I am not as other men are. Luke 18:11. That article was by David Gordon, and it was a book review of Hillary Clinton's book, Hard Choices. And so we see from almost all of the political candidates that an expansion of the government will be our solution. It will be our salvation. If only we can make the government bigger, we can impose the right rules on the right people, we can make the regulatory books even larger than they are today, then maybe, just maybe, we can solve the world's problems. But unfortunately, knowing economics helps us to understand what the real solutions are, and that is to get the government out of the way in as much as possible. The first place that I would start would be the Federal Reserve and the government's monopoly on the currency of a particular nation. So thanks so much for listening. This has been a presentation of the Austrian Circle. We'll be back next week for another episode. Have a great week. Take care.